How do you get to heaven? How do you get to heaven? Despite Britain's slide away from Christianity in recent decades, that's still a question that is on many people's lips, and perhaps in even more people's minds, particularly maybe as we get older. And instinctively, people seem to know that getting to heaven has surely got something to do with how we live here on earth. But if you were to ask people in clinic or indeed wider afield, if you were to ask them that question, how do you get to heaven, you'd have lots of different ideas. And perhaps everybody would have their own idea. But what matters is not your idea of how you get to heaven, nor indeed my idea. Well, what matters, of course, is what God says. Ultimately, it's Him who decides who gets to heaven, and it's Him who we need to hear. And what we're going to do this evening is exactly that. We're going to look at that question, how do you get to heaven? And we're going to look and to see how Jesus answers that question. And as we do so, we will discover that the answer that Jesus gives, if we take Him seriously, is a shocking answer. An answer that shocked the people in His day, and an answer, if only people would listen to it, that would shock the church in our day as well. There are four things that I want to say to you about the way Jesus answers this question. How do you get to heaven? Here's the first thing that I want to say to you. Don't think that God overlooks sin. Don't think that God overlooks sin. I'm looking here at Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 and 18 especially, because Jesus says there, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law, or indeed the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I say to you, until heaven and earth pass away," and that obviously hasn't happened yet, "not an iota, not a dot, will pass from the law until all that is accomplished." You see, there are lots of people who have this vague hope that somehow God will overlook their sin. They know, of course, that nobody is perfect, including them, and therefore they have this kind of vague hope. They perhaps might not be able to express it exactly in words, but this vague hope that God will at least overlook lots of their sin, that He'll somehow abolish, well, perhaps not all of the law. Maybe wouldn't expect Him to abolish "thou shalt not murder," although I'm sure there's some people who would hope He would, but at least that He would abolish some of the law, because if he doesn't abolish some of the law, if He doesn't overlook some of their sin, then they would have no hope of getting into heaven. And they therefore hope that that indeed is what Jesus will do. But Jesus makes very clear, doesn't He, from these verses, that's not what He's here for on earth. That's not why He came. He didn't come so that God could overlook sin. He didn't come so that to abolish the law. Why do people think that? Well, they think that really because perhaps they're trying to put together two, well, what might seem to be contradictory parts of the Bible. You see, on the one hand, the Bible teaches very clearly, doesn't it, that all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. There is no one righteous, not even one. The Bible's really, really clear about that. People read that perhaps, understand that. They understand themselves. They know that to be true. And yet there's other parts of the Bible that seem to suggest that we have a hope of heaven, or at least we can do. So how do we put these two things together? If we've all sinned, and yet it's possible to have a hope in heaven, some people conclude, well, it must be that God overlooks certain sins. That indeed is not what the Bible says, though, and Jesus is making that very clearly here, because the thoughts that people have today were the same sort of thoughts that they had in Jesus' day. And Jesus wants to make very clear the law still stands. That Old Testament law, those Ten Commandments that we think of, the two commandments, the way that Jesus sums up the Ten Commandments into the two. Do you remember the two commandments? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and you should love your neighbor as yourself. Those are the commandments. That's the law. And here Jesus is saying, I've not come to abolish any of that. If you fail to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, don't think that God will overlook that. If you fail to love your neighbor as yourself, don't think that God will overlook that. Jesus didn't come to abolish the law. Now you might think that's a bit unfair or a bit unkind. After all, if Jesus had come to abolish the law, then that would mean people could go to heaven, wouldn't it? Why wouldn't God want that? Well, to overlook the law, to abolish the law, would be unjust. Because what God requires from us is righteousness, is goodness. Why wouldn't God require that from us? And to relax his standards, to overlook hurt and pain and wrongdoing against others, what would that say about the character of God? So God will not overlook sin, because to be so would be unjust. And actually, as we will discover, God has something far better in store than simply overlooking sin. So that's the first thing we can learn from verses 17 and 18. Don't think God can overlook sin. And if there's something you feel I've missed from those verses, don't worry, we'll be coming back to them a little bit later in the message. But there's something else that I want to point out, this time from verse 19. Don't think that small sins don't matter. Don't think that small sins don't matter. Verse 19, Jesus talks there about whoever relaxes one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. You see, lots of us have this idea, in some ways a right idea, that there are big sins and that there are little sins. And that, of course, is true. There are some things that we do a small amount of harm, and there are some things that we do that do a very great deal of harm. And God indeed does view those things differently. But that is not to say that small sins are not sins at all. We sometimes talk, don't we, about white lies, lies that we tell that are no big deal. Well, there's no such thing in the Bible. God doesn't recognize such a category. There may be some sins that are worse than others, but all wrongdoing is sin. And Jesus wants to be very clear about that. Hey, even if all that you did was to relax, as the ESV puts it, untie is the word that's used in the Greek. You know that when Jesus taught the disciples untied the donkey to let Jesus ride on it? It's the same word here, loosening the law, perhaps. If all you did was to loosen or untie the very least commandment, Jesus, of course, doesn't tell us what that is because he doesn't want us to think that's okay. But even if that's all we were to do, that would mean that we would be the least in the kingdom of heaven, because in the world to come, in the kingdom of heaven, our status, if you like, the reward that God gives us, as he explains through the parable of the talents, is determined on how we live here. And it only takes one tiny little thing, one unloosening of the very least commandment, just one, and that would be enough to put you as least in the kingdom of heaven. You see, to relax the law, to loosen its hold on our conscience and its authority in our life, is an offense to God, because it's his law. And because it's important to him, then it should be important to us. And to disregard even the least commandment in the law is to, well, put ourselves then as the least subject in the kingdom. Because greatness in the kingdom, as Jesus makes very clear, belongs to those who are faithful in doing and teaching the whole of the law. You see, what Jesus is helping us to understand here is that the whole of the law ties together. Those of you who knit will know that sometimes it only takes a very small break in a knitted garment before the whole thing can become undone. It might seem just a tiny little tear, a tiny rip, but the whole thing is all bound together with that. James says in his letter, chapter 2 and verse 10, "For whoever keeps the whole law but falls in one point has become guilty of all of it." That's very sobering, isn't it? Whoever keeps the whole law but fails in one point has become guilty of all of it. And Jesus is saying something very similar here. So don't think that small sins don't matter, because they do. So don't think God overlooks sin. Don't think small sins don't matter. Verse 20 now, don't think that your best is good enough. Don't think that your best is good enough. You see, what we've done so far is we've looked at different views that often people have with regard to sin and heaven. Some people hope that God just overlooks all kinds of sin. Some people hope that God overlooks the small sins, the ones that, quote, you can't avoid, unquote. But lots of people, probably the majority of religious thinking people in this nation, have an idea that my best will be good enough. How will you get to heaven, you'll ask them. And they'll say, well, I'm not perfect, but I've done my best. Well, forgetting for a moment whether or not that is true, I don't think I've truly ever met anyone who really has done their best, least of all myself, of course. But even if that were true, that they really had done their best, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20 has something to say to them. Can you see it? "For I tell you," so this is an emphasis here Jesus is making, "for I tell you," he says, "unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." In other words, what Jesus is saying here is he's saying, look, I want you to think of the people who take the most effort and the most care, and give the most energy to keeping the law. Think of people like that. And of course, the crowds who were listening to Jesus would have immediately thought of the scribes and the Pharisees. That's what they're known for. They're known for doing all that they can to keep the law. So much so that because the law suggests that we should give a tenth of what we have, they're the ones who, when they're put in their sage, in their onion dressing for their turkey, then they get a tenth of their sage and they give that little piece to God. That's what they do. And Jesus says, think of the holiest scribe. Think of the holiest Pharisee that you can possibly imagine. And that person's not going to heaven because their righteousness is not enough. And you've got to do better than they. So don't think that your best is good enough. And it's tragic, isn't it, that despite Jesus' incredibly clear warnings, and of course not only Jesus, but all of the biblical writers, despite their incredibly clear warnings that our best is not good enough, so many people still today think that if they work hard, if they do their best, then somehow God will accept them. But you see, whether we follow the Jewish law, as the people here in Jesus' day were doing, and of course as many Jews still try and do today, it isn't good enough. If we try and follow Islamic law, as hundreds of millions of people do today, it isn't good enough. If we follow the law that some so-called Christians have invented, if we follow the laws of Catholicism, for example, it isn't good enough. If we follow the laws of moralistic Christian preaching, it isn't good enough. Now, in some of those instances, it's not good enough because the law itself doesn't meet God's standards. But in the other cases, the problem is not the law, the problem is us. You see, when Jesus is talking here about the law, he's talking about the law in a very positive way, isn't he? If the law was bad, Jesus would have come to abolish it. But the law is not bad. The law is good. We've said already, haven't we, that the law is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. That's a good law. Jesus didn't come to abolish that which is good. No, of course not. The problem's not with the law. The problem is with you and me. We simply cannot reach that standard. And the irony is that when we look around at those in religions that, well, really seek to instruct their people to keep the law in every jot and tittle, as the King James Version says, as in every iota and dot, then here's the thing. Those of us who have grown up in evangelical churches might look at, for example, Roman Catholics and think, what great demands the Catholic Church puts on their people. So many Hail Marys that need to be said, so many confessions that need to be made. We might look at Judaism and think, look at the demands that they put on their people. All of these food laws to keep, all of the Sabbath restrictions to work around somehow. Look at the great burden that they lay on those people. We might look at Muslims, and we might see the need for a pilgrimage. We might see that the harsh punishments and all these other things of the requirements that they lay. What harsh requirements these people put, these leaders put on their people. But here's the thing. In Catholicism, in Judaism, and in Islam, actually what those leaders are seeking to do, what those scholars are seeking to do, is to help their people to keep the law. They're not trying to add a burden, they're trying to make it easier. And actually what Jesus did in some ways is the opposite of that. You see, what Jesus did was he didn't do what the scholars of the day, the scribes, for example, did. They made everything clearer, but in some ways easier. But if you were to say to a Jewish scribe, am I in danger of breaking the commandments and not murder? They'd probably say, well, of all the commandments, you're probably okay on that one. But Jesus, if you've hated somebody in your heart, you're guilty of breaking that commandment. There would be many scribes who perhaps would encourage their people and say, well, you've been faithful to your wife all your life. At least there's that commandment that you haven't broken. The same in Catholicism, the same in Islam. And Jesus, if you've ever looked at a woman lustfully, then you've broken that commandment. You see, it's not just that Jesus didn't come to abolish the law, but it seems that almost Jesus came to reinforce the law. It's almost as if Jesus came to make the law even more demanding. He's not doing that, of course. He's not making the law even more demanding. He's helping us to see what the law has always demanded. He's helping us to get through the human laws that have been built on that actually, despite their weightiness, have been sought to make the law easier to keep. You see, that's what Jesus is saying. Don't think your best is good enough. It's not even that you'll just come a little way short. You will not get anywhere near the standard that God requires. So we've got to the end of our section here, haven't we? We've got to the end of Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 to 20. We've seen some of the views that people have, that there are people who think that God overlooks sin, and Jesus says, no way, I've not come to abolish the law at all. There are some people who say that the small sins at least don't matter, and Jesus says, don't even think about relaxing even the least of these commandments. And there are some people who say, well, my best is good enough. And Jesus says, the best of the very best of people in the scribes and the Pharisees, even that isn't good enough. So don't think your best will be. And it leaves us, perhaps as we get to the end of this section, with very little hope and very little promise. But those of you who were paying attention earlier on will have noticed that when we looked at verse 17 in particular, and also verse 18, there was a little something I missed out. And the little something I missed out is at the very heart of what Jesus is saying. And I deliberately wanted to finish there. And I want to go back, therefore, to verse 17, where Jesus says, "Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets." We've looked at that. I've not come to abolish them. But now Jesus says why he has come. Can you see it at the end of verse 17? I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. That's why Jesus came. He came to fulfill the law. And if you look at the commentaries, you will find all kinds of different views as to what this exactly means. He talks about the prophets as well, doesn't he? And some people think here in terms of prophecy. Well, the Old Testament speaks about Jesus and prophesies about him. And now that he's come, he's fulfilling those prophecies. There's a sense, of course, in which that's true. But Jesus is saying much more than that. There are some people who say, we have these commands from the Old Testament. We have the summary of the law in Jesus' words, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And what Jesus has come to do is to show and to demonstrate what that looks like in practice. And so he's fulfilling the law in that way. But that's not what fulfilling means, is it? What does it mean to fulfill something? Well, to fulfill something, maybe you've made a promise. And you've said to somebody, on such an occasion, I'll do this for you. What does it take to fulfill your promise? Well, you've got to do what you said you will do. And then your promise is fulfilled, isn't it? That's what fulfillment means, to accomplish, to finish the job. So what did Jesus come to do? He came to fulfill the law. So what does the law do? What the law does is the law makes demands on every human being on this planet, you and me and everyone else. That's what the law does. Paul calls it a schoolmaster. And schoolmasters make demands of us. They tell us to learn our tables. They tell us to get our homework in on time. They tell us to do this and not do that. That's the law. It makes demands on us. And it does, doesn't it? It demands that we love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul, and strength. It demands that we love our neighbor as ourselves. It demands and demands and demands. And what do you and I have? Well, as the law makes its demands, if there was a tally chart in heaven, as it were, what would come up day after day after day for you and me? Fail to meet the demands. Fail to meet the demands. Fail to meet the demands. And there's this enormous debt, as it were, in heaven against each of our names. Some of you have been in debt. You know what it is to get an envelope through at the end of the month. They used to be red, didn't they? They don't make them red anymore. But you'd get that red demand. You've missed your payment. The debt is there. And you failed in your obligations. Metaphorically, that's what all of us have in heaven. Failed, 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 failed. This great debt has been built up. And Jesus doesn't have failed against his name, not ever. When Jesus came from heaven to earth, what did he do? What did he do? He fulfilled all righteousness. That's what he did. He fulfilled all righteousness. Every demand, every right demand that God made, Jesus Christ kept those demands. When God says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, Jesus did it. And he did it with all his heart. And he did it with all his mind. And he did it with all his strength. And he did it with all his soul. He fulfilled that law. And when God said, love your neighbor as yourself, Jesus loved his neighbor, didn't he? Even more than himself. He fulfilled that law. So what does that mean? It means the law has been completed. It means the law has been finished. We talk about the finished work of Christ. And the finished work of Christ was not just that he finished his work of atonement, dying in our place. It means too that he finished fulfilling righteousness. That as he died there on the cross, that was the greatest command, if you like, that God had given to him. The greatest test of Jesus' righteousness and obedience. If he could be obedient even to the point of death, then clearly Jesus has now fulfilled all righteousness. Your best is not good enough. My best is not good enough. But his best is more than good enough. And what this means is this, that in our day and our generation, the law has not been abolished. It still stands. It still demands of every human being, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Those are good demands that we cannot meet, and the law still makes those demands. But in Jesus Christ, we have one who has fulfilled, completed, finished the law. And that means this, and this is to be played out as we go through Matthew's gospel and indeed into Paul's letters. We discover that by putting our faith and our trust in Jesus Christ, then his fulfillment of the law is given to us. And therefore, when God demands from heaven, John, you need to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. You must love your neighbor as yourself. John is able to say, as it were, I've done that. Or rather, Christ has done that for me. And because I am trusting in him and in him alone, he has kept the law. And just as though when those envelopes come through the front door with those demands and that debt, once that debt is paid, then there's no more demand. And Jesus has paid that debt. In fact, he's done more than that, hasn't he? Because Jesus has not only paid that debt and left us with zero balance, but he's paid that debt and given us all the credit of his righteousness, so that our balance in heaven, if you like, is now into the positive numbers, inestimable, unimaginable numbers. You see, if we think that our best is good enough, we will fall short. If we think that small sins don't matter, we will fool ourselves. If we think that God overlooks sin, we'll make him out to be a liar. But if we trust in Christ's righteousness alone, we will find that Jesus really did come, not to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law. And all that remains for me to do is to ask you, are you trusting in Christ's righteousness alone? Not in your own, but in his, because there is no other name under heaven by which we must be saved.